Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. Later in today's show, we'll be joined by the D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation to talk about the latest in the Trump administration's efforts to remake the executive branch, from the confirmation of RFK Jr. as Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary, to plans to gut the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, to yesterday's announced mass firings of federal workers. But first, we're going to look at the economic and human toll of Trump's deportation policy. Donald Trump ratcheted up his anti-immigration rhetoric during his campaign last year, promising to deport millions and millions of undocumented immigrants. And a new investigation by our guest today provides an insight into what happened to communities that get caught up in ICE's raids. Operation Wagon Train hit Swift meat plants in six states on December 12, 2006, arresting nearly 1,300 workers. In the tiny Texas town of Cactus, nearly 300 were taken into custody. That's 10% of the town's population. It was the largest workplace raid in U.S. history. And an investigator of what happened back in 2006 and today's guest, Jack Herrera, writes, the 2006 Swift raids provide a model for the immigration enforcement that many of his supporters, meaning Trump supporters, have been clamoring for. They were nationwide and high octane, with hundreds of immigrants detained and deported. But the aftermath offers a less tidy example. Today, some 40% of all meatpacking workers in the nation are foreign-born. And according to one report, the proportion of workers who are undocumented at any given plant ranges from 14% to more than 50%. Jack Herrera is an award-winning independent reporter covering the border and Latino communities. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Politico magazine, The Guardian, and elsewhere. Jack, thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Thanks so much, Ethan. It's good to be here.
And thank you also for this important article. As you argue, what happened in the Swift meat packing plant company back in 2006 really offers warnings about Donald Trump's plans for mass deportations today. Even though it happened back in 2006, it's potentially an indication of what's going to happen to these small communities in particular. And before we get into the details of what happened back in 2006, I just first want to take a step back and ask you, what do you make of the media coverage of immigration today, and particularly Trump's calls for mass deportation, how the media is covering that, and his so-called border czar, Tom Homan, who has been very outspoken about these mass deportation plans?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're seeing right now is a sort of adaptation. Like, we're trying, reporters, myself included, are trying to understand what is the actual state now? What is the new normal? What does the expansion look like? You see, in the first week when Trump takes office, you see ICE is posting daily arrest totals, on social media for the first week. And then suddenly they stopped doing that. And so we don't really have a day-by-day idea of how many people are being arrested. It looks like there's been a significant expansion of arrests. The number of percent of those who are have criminal records, unknown. The number of deportations has not gone up. And actually, the ICE detention, there's a decent number of people who have been released because ICE reached capacity pretty quickly. I think that, to put it simply, I think if the media is making one mistake, it is portraying the Biden administration as, I guess, not as intense on deportation and enforcement as the Trump administration is. But Biden really had the pedal pressed, the gas pressed almost all the way to the floor when it came to enforcement. The number of arrests, the number of deportations, the number of people removed from the country in his term was record-setting. And often he was deporting and expelling people at a higher rate than Trump during his first term. So the room that ICE has to expand its enforcement, there's not a lot of wiggle room. So it's really a sort of wait and see. How are they going to make that expansion? How are they going to hit the quotas that Trump has set for deportations?
Well, you make a great point that the Biden administration was not really known and not really covered by the media for its immigration enforcement. And at the same time, the Trump administration seems to be doing these almost made for TV, made for the media kinds of high profile deportation moves. And as you point out, you know, the data may not really indicate how widespread these are, but they're really making media showcases out of the deportation raids that have happened, using military flights to relocate undocumented immigrants. Is the media in some ways falling for this sort of strategy by the Trump administration to make it seem high profile how they're taking action on illegal immigration?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just a big readership, big viewership, big, you know, listenership for people who want to hear about these ICE raids. Like it gets a lot of clicks. And so I think that there's a real, when there's a spectacle, that gets a lot of attention. And there's just so much happening that there's a sort of bias towards the breaking news, towards the most spectacular raids, the most shocking images. I also think, I mean, when you talk about the media unwittingly going along with it, I think we have to talk about the section of the media that's wittingly going along with it. Like, I don't think it's a coincidence that during these, you know, early morning 5 a.m. raids, the Fox News cameras are there along with them. Mm-hmm. I think that the administration, it's pretty clear that the administration is giving friendly media a heads up before ahead of these raids, at the same time that it's complaining about leaks, about the, you know, news of raids being leaked ahead of time. So I think there's definitely, you make a really good point. There's a real relationship between the media coverage and the enforcement itself. And that's because Trump has a prerogative. It's not just to raise the numbers, it's to make people feel like something is being done. And so that's all maybe the most important part of his policy at this point, which is to his base elected him to really bring the pain, really bring his foot down when it comes to immigration enforcement. And so the administration is going to do everything they can to create that impression, to make people feel like they're bringing the pain.
We're speaking with Jack Herrera, award-winning independent reporter covering the border and Latino communities. And we're talking on Your Calls Media Roundtable today about Trump's immigration plans and an example from the past that might be a example of what is to come nationwide, particularly in small towns. And Jack, I want to talk now about your article, a really fascinating, in-depth coverage of what happened to a small town in the Texas Panhandle back in 2006 when an ICE raid swept through the Swift Beef Meatpacking Company in that town, ultimately leading to the deportation of 10% of the town's residents. Can you tell us more about what happened? Set the scene here. What happened back in 2006 in Cactus?
Yeah, so Cactus is a town built entirely around this enormous slaughterhouse. And so in 2006, it was called the Swift Beef Plant. There's about 3,000 workers. There's about 600 workers working the plant, 3,000 people in the town. It is the major employer. The town moves around this plant. And so on early morning in December in 2006, the plant's entirely windowless. So people didn't see it coming, but townspeople saw buses, you know, enormous amounts of ICE buses and agents arrive. A break is called within the plant. Nobody knows what's going on. And then suddenly there's chaos. The people I talked to who were there that day say that everyone was sprinting around the plant. Workers are screaming that there are people with machine guns in the plant sweeping along the floor. And the scenes of fear and chaos that follow really, really stunning. There are people who are in the locker room pushing up the ceiling tiles to crawl into the crawl space. There are people hiding behind machines or trying to, you know, get into crawl spaces underneath the conveyor belts. One of the most shocking images is people getting into the carcasses of cows, hiding themselves in these bloody, recently slaughtered cow bellies to hide from ICE and immigration. And at the end of the day, over 300 people, almost 300 people are arrested. That's 10% of the town, half of the plant's workforce. And you have many instances of two parents or being arrested, being zip tied, put on these buses out of town. And so you have dozens of children in Cactus who were parentless that night. Mm-hmm. And it was really unknown what could happen to them. So there's a big push by the Catholic Church and the school system to have these kids fed and sheltered and find just a place to spend that night, even as they figure out what's going to happen. Their parents are now in a different country. What happens next? Even people who support strict immigration enforcement that I spoke to said that this was a real traumatic event. This was a really hard day for them.
Absolutely. Very heartbreaking to think that kids coming out of school don't even know that their parents are now detained and they may not see them again. And this was 10% of the town's population. You talk about what happened in the aftermath here to have 10% of the town suddenly disappear. What was that like for Cactus?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to ICE agents who make the point that this is not the good part of their job when they're arresting parents and they've got to break up families. But the idea is for people who are in favor of a really strict immigration policy, Donald Trump being the spokesperson of that, is that there's this immediate trauma. It's taking disappearing 10% of a town is going to devastate any town. right? Like no matter how big or small it is, that's an enormous change. But the idea is after that initial shock, something good happens, and that makes it worth it, which is the fact that now you've gotten rid of these foreign employees who are working here illegally. Once you get rid of them, that'll increase competition for employees, wages will go up, and then native-born Americans or citizens with work permits, immigrants with work permits, legal workers will take those jobs at a higher rate. And so you see something positive happen. And so you see after the raid, swift immediately, the wages were already some of the highest in the area. The workers, undocumented or otherwise, were making good money. But they raised wages about 8%, start a nationwide hiring push to hire people who have legal status to work in the plant. And what happens is they can't find anybody. The number of people that they're trying to fill half the jobs, and they're really only finding a token number of citizens or Texans or locals to come work the plant. Americans just don't seem to want to work in slaughterhouses. And so the population that ends up being hired to work at the plant is refugees. There's a population of immigrants that do have work permits, do have legal status. And so this town of Cactus, it's a tiny town up in the rural panhandle, but it's one of the more diverse places in Texas because you have Burmese and Somalian and Venezuelan and Haitian and just people from all over the world, mm-hmm. Laotian, Vietnamese. Like the population is, it's basically, it's a UN. It's a little UN in a meatpacking town up in the North Panhandle.
It's amazing to think about that kind of diversity, but also the fact that this meatpacking slaughterhouse is exploiting its workers, that it can only survive if it has undocumented workers or those in precarious refugee status to be able to make the economics work in this factory. And the fact that they were able to pay more, they were able to offer 8% more in salary when they weren't exploiting undocumented labor. Talk more about this factory. What happened? What was its situation prior to the raid? And what is the current state of this factory?
Yeah, I mean, this gets to a really important question for us to try to understand, which is there are industries, meatpacking among them, that really rely on undocumented workers. A huge percentage of the meatpacking industry's workforce is undocumented. And so the real question, Ethan, is why? Why are we hiring so many undocumented workers? And one version of that story goes that people hire undocumented workers because they're able to pay them less, and they're able to exploit them more because undocumented workers are less likely to organize or to raise a huff or to report to authorities because of fear of deportation. Another version of this, though, is the fact that this plant raised wages and then ended up hiring immigrants again, is that the wages that you need to pay a native-born American to work in a slaughterhouse are pretty phenomenally high. And I think this is the point that goes misunderstood, which is that we are not living in a time of mass unemployment where a lot of Americans are out of work. We're living in a time of actually historic labor shortages. And the meatpacking industry is really struggling to find workers. Wages have gone up pretty significantly in the last 4 or 5 years. They're really trying to get workers. They do want to hire anybody they can. But the wages haven't been enough to attract U.S. citizens. And let me give you a real example of that. I talked to this guy, Juan Lara, who grew up in the Cactus area in a town a little bit south called Dumas, went to Dumas High School. Now he works in the plant. And I asked him, how many people from your high school work in the plant? And he's like, less than 10. Like nobody from the high school goes to work there. And that shocked me because the plant pays more than any other job. If you only have a high school degree, you're working in manual labor, there's basically one other job you can work in the rural panhandle that's going to pay you more than the beef plant. And that's the Valero refinery, which pays, significantly more. But this is one of the best paying jobs you could possibly have in this area. And people still aren't showing up. It's paying, $24 an hour off the street, and you can go up to, about $30 an hour. So this is, with overtime, people are making $60,000-$70,000, which, that's more than the median wage in the country. And it's also just significantly higher than jobs in the rural panhandle. So it basically doesn't come down to wages. Like, these are high pay. I think the fact is that the job is brutal. You're stripping, skin off a cow and cutting its neck to drain it out. Like, it's a work that, I think a lot of us would have to be paid a lot of money to be willing to do.
Yeah, you know, I think about coal mining, which is also a really difficult, dangerous job. And those jobs famously can pay $80,000, $100,000 coming out of high school with no college degree needed in really rural areas. So it does seem like if they were to raise wages, you could attract American citizens to do these jobs. But as you point out in your article, that it would add to the prices that we pay. So in some ways, it feels like what we're paying for these products is artificially low because we're paying for exploited labor, that these companies are taking advantage of. What would you make of that argument that essentially this is a subsidized product that's artificially cheap because of these exploitative labor practices, that we actually paid a competitive market wage for labor that wasn't in a desperate situation, that we'd all have to pay more for this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the pandemic and supply chain crises showed us that Americans are extremely sensitive to prices going up in the grocery store. If beef prices increase, Americans basically aren't willing to pay more. That led to, basically like mass unrest. Like people were really upset about inflation over the last 4 years. So I think if you raise wages enough to have, to attract people who would otherwise be going to work office jobs, or somebody who's going to go work in a cafe or, to get them to go move to the rural panhandle and work in the slaughterhouse instead, you'd have to raise wages really significantly. And of course, that would be translated into the price of the product itself. Meatpacking doesn't work on huge margins. It's not, they've got exploited workers and there's, but they're making so much profit there. I mean, there is room to pay workers more, and workers do deserve to be paid more. And the union that represents the workers, the plants in Cactus, has been pretty successful, like negotiating higher wages every time their contract comes up. The question, though, I mean, I think that there's a huge amount of exploitation in the meatpacking industry. Worker living conditions in particular are awful. It's one of the more dangerous jobs in America. The pandemic during COVID, it swept through these plants. So yes, let's just like underline that these workers are exploited, and that's part of why beef prices stay down. The real question, though, is like how much you need to raise wages to attract native-born Americans. And I don't think we take it seriously enough how hard it is to convince Americans, native-born Americans, to go do the sort of manual labor. Mm-hmm. There's across the industry manual labor, like construction workers, for instance, a huge percent of them are undocumented. And I think it's a misconception that they're underpaid, that they're uniformly underpaid, that these jobs that people are making, especially in the trades, you're making often six figures. Mm-hmm. And even those jobs that are making six figures, you're making 60 or 70 out of high school, they're having extreme labor shortages. They're having trouble finding people to do these jobs. Yeah. And I think that that's a sort of cultural trend that's underappreciated.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great point and such complicated dynamics. I do want to open the phone lines for listeners who would like to join this conversation. If you have thoughts about undocumented immigration and its effect on the labor market, if you have thoughts about these types of raids, if you've been victimized by these raids or know someone who has and want to talk about what that does to a community, to a neighborhood, to a family, the phone lines are open and the number to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email with any questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. This is Your Call's Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we're talking to Jack Herrera, award-winning independent reporter covering the border and Latino communities, about what happened in one small town of Cactus, Texas, after a ICE raid of that town literally deported 10% of the town's residents. And Jack, there was one fascinating part of your article which featured fairly prominently Pablo Valdez, one of the plant's head superintendents, who was there and saw what happened and saw the impact, and yet is a Trump supporter and believes that Trump's immigration policies are not going to come back to haunt him or to come back to his town. Can you talk about Pablo Valdez and the complicated nature of his politics?
Yeah, I mean, Pablo was a passionate Trump supporter, and he does support Trump's immigration policy because he says, I think the quote he gave me is a lot of people wreaking havoc, undocumented immigrants are committing crime, and he really supports that population being deported. But when I asked him, how would you feel about a workplace raid, like if they raided another meatpacking plant or they came, he works in roofing, and there's a lot of undocumented workers in roofing. What if they came and raided construction sites? And Pablo's like, that'd be horrible. I think it's a really bad thing. I don't think it's bad for business, bad for communities. And so I asked him, well, Pablo, then why are you supporting Trump? Because Trump has said that that's exactly what he wants to do. He wants to do these mass deportations. And Pablo said, and I think this is, astute. He said that, I don't think they're going to do that. I think that they're going to make these ICE raids, they're going to arrest criminals, but I don't think they're going to do these mass workplace raids because they know whatever they say in public, whatever Trump says in his speeches, he knows that the economy relies on undocumented workers, that if you raided all the construction sites where they're building houses in Texas, so you raided all the meatpacking plants, the price of beef goes up, the price of housing goes up, and the administration doesn't want that. And so he's confident that that's not going to happen. And so far, there hasn't been a major workplace raid. It's only, less than a month into the Trump administration. But that's sort of the big question. Like, as they do their big raids, are they going to start hitting work sites the way that ICE has done in the past?
It's certainly a big bet. It's a big bet for someone like him. And, you could imagine that being the case, that Trump is highly aware of the bad optics of deporting people. He talked about that in the campaign. And as we talked about earlier, just in this show, how a lot of this seems to be about just sort of high profile raids made for media, but the data not really showing a mass deportation yet. But of course, I think for those who are living in fear, that may not be much comfort. And I know that you've been covering the town just in environment today, and that following this raid, many of those undocumented immigrants a few weeks later, Valdez noted that he saw many of them back in town working in other jobs. But I'm curious what you could talk about is happening today in Cactus. It seems like so many people are living in fear. They're not making that bet that this is just for show. Can you talk about what's going on in the town?
Yeah, I mean, so I was there right before the inauguration. And, you see within days of the inauguration, there are rumors flying around the town that ICE is in Cactus. You got to be careful, like stay inside because ICE is doing raids. And to the best of my knowledge, there's no truth to those rumors that ICE hadn't conducted any raids in Texas, in that part of Texas. But there's enormous fear. And I've seen that. I'm based out of New York right now. I see that, there's rumors going around that ICE is in the hospitals. And I've heard from doctors who say that patients aren't showing up for appointments in clinic because they're worried about ICE. And so the fear is very real. And I think that, I think that it was when it was sort of just a concept, during the campaign that mass deportation, he's going to get rid of the criminals. A lot of people could say, well, he's not going to come after me, or he's not going to come after my town because we're not criminals here. But now you see ICE, these sort of high profile stories of ICE just fanning out neighborhoods or in Denver, for instance, or going door to door. I think it's led to a lot of fear. And I think that one of the substances of that fear is the sense that anything could happen, that, an ICE raid that goes door to door, an ICE raid that arrests an entire factory, an ICE raid that, arrests parents with citizen children. I think that's the fear, is that it sort of seems like everything's on the table. Mm-hmm.
So, Jack, we have a listener question. Ed in San Francisco writes in, why doesn't ICE go after the company for violating hiring laws instead of the undocumented workers?
Yeah, such a great question. And I think that's really interesting to statistic that you see in 2019. I believe it was Reuters did an analysis of ICE work site enforcement under Trump. And you do see the number of arrests at work sites goes up, but the prosecution of employers has actually went down from Obama to Trump, or didn't, went down, a tiny bit, but basically didn't meaningfully change, didn't go up. And so you see, as they're targeting workers, there isn't this emphasis on targeting employers. And I think that's consistent in the rhetoric too, right? There's not a lot of bluster and bombast about, we need to go after people who hire undocumented immigrants. The message is always, we need to deport undocumented immigrants. And I think it raises a real question. If you're passionate about enforcement, if you want to decrease the undocumented population in this country, or discourage people from coming and working for undocumented, the quickest way to do that is make it a lot harder for there to be jobs, because it is the extreme and enormous demand for labor that keeps this process happening. The economy relies so fundamentally on these workers that there's enormous demand, and that means that there's this perpetual unending movement to this country to work these jobs. And so without worksite enforcement, you're not going to make a meaningful dent in it. And it's really, I think it is a really good question, a really curious question, why there isn't the sort of passionate campaign for going after employers who are misclassifying or exploiting their workers, paying them less than they deserve.
And wouldn't that be an opening for Democrats? I mean, traditionally, Democrats, going back to their New Deal roots, were very much against businesses exploiting workers. Wouldn't that be a tactic that or an argument that the Democrats could make, that we really need to be cracking down on big businesses for their labor practices?
Yeah. I mean, Ethan, that's a great way of asking the question. And I think another way of saying that is, like, what is the problem with undocumented workers working in the country? And if the idea is that they're not being paid a fair wage, they're being exploited, they're being kept in poor conditions, the solution to that, or one solution, is to make sure that workers cannot pay the workers sub-minimum wage. Make sure workers aren't misclassifying their employees as contractors. Make sure employers aren't cheating their employees or stealing their wages or keep putting them in dangerous conditions. If you make all those, if you start basically going after businesses and say, I don't care, you know, what citizenship status your workforce is, we have wage laws in this, we have labor laws in this country, and you need to be paying people a fair market wage. You need to be keeping them in safe conditions, and you need to be correctly classifying them as employees and paying them, and having, you know, having their pay go to Social Security and taxes, and not just paying them a cash into the table. And that's obviously not just a problem for undocumented immigrants. There's a lot of citizens in this country who get paid cash into the table or get exploited, you know? And so I think that is a way of saying, like, you know what? Yeah, people are being cheated. Laborers are not being paid their fair share. Part of that is because undocumented immigrants are being taken advantage of. Let's make big business pay a fair wage to workers. Let's make them pay fair taxes. I think there's a real opening for that. That is the problem mass deportation is trying to solve. So why not just start at the source and just get people to pay the labor what it's worth?
Even if it means paying a few extra cents for some of our products. Well, Jack, we're almost out of time. I just wanted to end by asking you, what are you working on now? What do you see as a sort of the next big story in immigration and the issues on the border in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a real question to see. Under the Biden administration, they were able to push Mexico to massively increase their enforcement in Mexico of migrants moving northward. And that's continued under Trump. And that means that over the last year, number of crossings are actually way down. And so the question I have is, the two major questions I have about how many people are arriving on the border is how long Mexico will keep up that massively increased enforcement. And then secondly, how long the smuggler networks and the cartels that move people northward will keep this wait and see approach. They're waiting for the policy to change so they can start moving people north again. But if the policy doesn't change, if Mexican enforcement continues, maybe they say, you know what, we're just going after this. We're going to get business where we can. And so we're going to, like, even with this increased enforcement, we're going to move northward. So that's the sort of wait and see on the border. When it comes to this country, my major interest is I'm looking at all these industries with fantastic labor shortages. Manufacturing, agriculture, meatpacking, like we've been talking about, construction, they're having trouble hiring people. And these are also the industries that hire the most undocumented workers. And so I'm really curious to see if this sort of shock therapy Trump is putting on the system, trying to get rid of undocumented workers, get Americans working these jobs, if that can be successful. Because right now these industries are really struggling to hire American workers. It's like, it's like the body going through withdrawal if you're getting rid of if you're trying to overcome an addiction. Like, the economy for so long has been dependent on these workers. Can it transition? Can it transform so substantially that it doesn't rely on them anymore? That's a real question that I don't think we're taking seriously enough.
Well, we've got your work cut out for you. There's so many issues to cover, and we're glad that you're on the ground bringing these stories to us. Jack Herrera, award-winning independent reporter covering the border and Latino communities, whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Politico Magazine, The Guardian, and elsewhere. Thank you so much for joining us on Friday's Your Call Media Roundtable.
Thank you so much, Ethan.
All right, and coming up next, we're going to talk about the latest in Trump world, from the confirmation of RFK Jr. to the closure of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau to announced layoffs of thousands of federal workers. Stay with us. This is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back right after this short break. Welcome back. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable on this Friday. Happy Valentine's Day. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, where you can also listen to our past shows there. And if you have a show idea for us, something we should cover in the coming weeks, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. And now there's so much happening with the Trump administration's plans to remake the executive branch. We're going to talk about all of these latest events in some depth here. First of all, yesterday, the Senate confirmed Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to head the Health and Human Services Department. RFK Jr. now oversees one of the key health agencies with about 80,000 employees and a $1.7 trillion budget. And now also we have Elon Musk and Donald Trump turning their attention to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, not one of the best acronyms, but an important agency created in the aftermath of the financial crisis to protect people from financial fraud, abuse, and deceptive business practices. According to PBS NewsHour, the Washington headquarters has been shut down for the week, and there are fears that it will be gutted like the U.S. Agency for International Development was in the initial weeks of the Trump administration. And then finally, yesterday, CNN reported that Trump and Musk have fired thousands of probationary government workers across the federal government. It's really head-spinning all that has been happening in these last few weeks, and that's why we're so pleased to be joined to talk about these latest developments and the media coverage of this now month-old Trump administration by Chris Lehman, the D.C. bureau chief for The Nation and a contributing editor at The Baffler. He was formerly editor of The Baffler and The New Republic and is the author most recently of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Good to have you on the show, Chris.
Thanks, Ethan. It's always a pleasure.
So let's start off with RFK Jr. He was sworn in as Health and Human Services Secretary. Got to start there. After the Senate confirmed him on a largely party line vote. Interestingly enough, Senator Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, former Senate Majority Leader, childhood polio survivor, was the only Republican that did not vote for him, given his controversial and discredited stance on a whole host of issues, including the vaccines and research on infectious diseases. What do you make of RFK Jr. running the country's national health system? What are the things we should be following and concerned about?
Well, how much time do you have, Ethan? It's a long list. He's already sort of sent out advisories that he's going to do an aggressive review of serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which is just antidepressant drugs. He is, as you note, a vaccine skeptic. He famously got involved in an anti-vax campaign in Samoa that resulted in the deaths of several, I don't remember the exact number now, but many children on the ground there. All of these, positions in a sane political order should have been, the occasion for, outright disqualification for a job this important. The Department of Health and Human Services actually has the highest budget of any federal agency. And we have someone who is, not just anti-vax, but in important respects, anti-science, in charge. And it's not hyperbole to say people are going to die as a result of this lunatic conspiracy theorist being granted this much power. It's bad in short.
I want to go ahead and open the phone lines, given this development. And I know there's a lot of people have strong feelings about this. If you are concerned about RFK Jr. as Secretary of Department of Health and Human Services, if you're dependent on its programs and want to talk about those potential impacts, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. So we also have another big story with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. It was created, as I mentioned, in response to the 2008 financial crisis, enforcing all sorts of consumer financial laws for mortgages, credit cards, other financial products. Can you talk about the latest there? This agency has really been in the crosshairs of Elon Musk in particular. How important is this agency, and what's the latest now with this saga?
It's, as you noted, the CFPB was founded in the aftermath of the 2008 financial meltdown, with the mission of, you know, protecting the interests of ordinary consumers amid conditions of rampant financial fraud. So it has done really important work in eliminating things like medical debt on your credit reports, getting rid of overdraft fees on checking and credit card accounts, you know, cracking down on predatory lending. It's actually a really valuable government agency. And Elon Musk, along with every other, you know, sort of right-wing oligarch in this country, has long hated it. And, you know, the math here isn't complicated. People amass vast fortunes by bilking consumers, and any agency that gets in the way of that is going to be demonized. And, you know, the Republican Party has been calling for the elimination of the CFPB virtually since it was founded. And now Musk and his, you know, roving band of Doge bros got their infiltrated CFPB last week. And, you know, Musk, as he did earlier with the USAID sacking, took to Twitter claiming to find all these instances of fraud that were just complete fabrications. And, you know, the sort of real storyline here is that Musk actually, I think 9 days before the Doge siege at CFPB, announced plans to introduce a digital wallet on the X platform he owns. And this is another area in which CFPB has been, the agency has been regulating the drift of tech giants into finance very closely. So, you know, as with everything Musk does, there's a howling conflict of interest here. And he's basically, you know, been empowered to eliminate the agency that would have exerted oversight over his, you know, plan to expand X into the financial sector. So, you know, it's another shockingly corrupt and unconstitutional power grab in an administration that has been producing them on a virtually daily basis. And, you know, ordinary consumers are going to suffer grievously as a result.
Well, so much to talk about there. Just want to let listeners know we're talking to Chris Lehman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation and a contributing editor at The Baffler. Also the author most recently of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. We're talking about the latest going on in the Trump executive branch, from the confirmation of RFK Jr. as Secretary of Health and Human Services to what's happening with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And Chris, as you mentioned, this bureau plays a really important role protecting consumers. And there's a lot of self-interested dealings here. People like Musk, who don't want the scrutiny, especially as you mentioned, if his social media company, former Twitter, now X, is going into financial payments, which would then put it under the purview of this bureau. Can you talk about what this could mean to average people? It seems like so much of the work of this bureau is really kind of unsung. We don't really even realize how the work that it's doing is protecting us from fraud and abuse in corporate malpractice. Can you talk a bit about what you think this is going to mean for people, average everyday people?
Yeah, well, as I wrote in my piece for The Nation about this development, you know, this sort of functions as call of Ali Ali Oxenfree to bad actors in the financial sector, and the order to basic Russell Vought. I forgot this, you know, everything's been happening so quickly. So Russell Vought, the deranged Christian nationalist director of the Office of Management and Budget, appointed himself or was appointed provisional director of CFPB, and he has this lunatic, paranoid idea that any agency engaged in any kind of regulation is basically a cultural Marxist plot against true believing Christians. I'm, this is not an exaggeration. So when he basically ordered the suspension, you noted earlier that all CFPB people have been staying home this past week from the office here in Washington. Bot also ordered the suspension of all pending legal cases, all pending regulatory actions. So right now, you know, this vast body I mentioned, you know, they've done important things like rescuing people with medical debt from bankruptcy and worse. They've gotten rid of all kinds of overdraft fees, all kinds of junk fees, which you probably remember the Biden administration made a big deal of. And all those things are going to come creeping back. There's just literally going to be no oversight for all of this. And you know, it's the other, you know, gruesome development in this is that as Russell Vought was shutting everything down, he discovered sort of in the nick of time that CFPB also basically is the agency that ensures mortgage rates remain stable. And he was going to rip that out with all of the other wiring there. And, you know, we could have been plunged very rapidly into another disastrous housing crisis as a result of that. You know, fortunately, some sane person remained on the scene and told him, Russ, you know, you should really walk this back. But, you know, that's the new reality we're living in, is we're, you know, sort of veering headlong into potential financial catastrophe at the hands of ideological zealots who have no idea what they're actually doing.
Just as a reminder to listeners, this is Friday's Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we're talking with Chris Lehman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation and a contributing editor at The Baffler, about the latest in Trump world. And we were talking about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and you made a comment, Chris, that this is really an unconstitutional kind of power grab, that these, not just the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but all of these agencies are authorized by Congress, with spending authorized by Congress, allocated by the Congress, and the executive branch does not have the unilateral ability to simply shut down an agency and disregard what a Congress, even if it's a previous Congress, has legislated. Those are the people's representatives. So where does what Trump is doing to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau fit in to the larger, essentially legal constitutional landscape of pushback to trying to stop the Trump administration from freezing spending and laying off people? Where is this fitting in?
Well, there is CFPB's union, which is a Treasury Department union, has filed a suit, two suits actually, to arrest this. And I think there's been a preliminary injunction to at least stave off the immediate prospect of, you know, hollowing the place out and breaking it up. But the, you know, the big question hovering, you know, and there have been similar actions, of course, in reversing the federal grant cessation that happened early on, in reversing the USAID assault and reversing the suspension of NIH grants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so far with one exception, you know, judges have sided with the plaintiffs who are challenging these power grabs. But the big question, which Musk and J.D. Vance and others have already sort of broached, is there could come a time when this administration that's so drunk on its own executive power will just disregard court rulings, and then a real constitutional crisis is going to ensue. I mean, this is a bit of a side issue, but, you know, yesterday was the what is already being called the Thursday afternoon massacre, with the Justice Department seeking to implement this corrupt deal to get Eric Adams off the hook for his federal corruption charges. And I think as of now, three prosecutors in the Justice Department have resigned over this flagrant abuse of power, which is, you know, at a minimum, much worse than Watergate.
So it shows you how much our political culture has changed, that this would have sunk any presidential administration, you know, prior to 2017. I do want to ask you about the mass federal layoffs that were announced that CNN has reported. What's the latest on that? And what exactly can Democrats do to push back?
Well, I mentioned the CFPB union is doing this suit, you know, basically to, you know, prevent its employees from being cashiered en masse. And the other suits I mentioned are very much, you know, in that same vein, seeking to achieve the same objectives. And, you know, as for the other people who've been dismissed so far, first of all, there are 75,000 people who took the basically buyout offer that the Trump administration tendered to federal workers. It's not clear that that's a significant number beyond what normal attrition is for a year in the federal workforce. And then there are 200,000 probationary workers who have been dismissed. And a lot of those are at the Office of Personnel and Management, which is the home, basically. That's the first agency that DOGE sort of laid siege to. So that's something to keep a very close eye on. You know, I think DOGE, you know, in my view, has no real constitutional reason to exist. If they're able to sort of completely infiltrate from within an agency like OPM and are joining forces with, you know, Russell Bott, things look really bad. And, you know, the remedies that Democrats have in terms of what they can do in Congress are quite limited, just because Democrats are not in the majority. They can, you know, this is stuff I think they should have been doing from the, you know, outside of the Trump administration. They should have been slow walking all of the cabinet confirmation votes. Instead, the Senate, the reason RFK got confirmed yesterday, he actually got moved up on the schedule because the Senate wanted to go to Germany on a stupid junket. So there, you know, there isn't a sense of urgency that I can see. You know, they all get up and make speeches, of course, and issue statements. But senators, Democratic senators, and Chuck Schumer in particular, have been, you know, asleep at the switch. I'm putting it kindly, I think.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that might have some leverage coming up with the budget negotiations and the debt limit. But in the meantime, what about pushback within the Republican Party? I know it would be quiet pushback. The party seems very much cowed by Trump and his supporters. Right. But, you know, many of these cutbacks are affecting Republican constituents, Republican congressional districts.
Absolutely. I mean,
many of the thousands of people fired in the federal government were departments of Veterans Affairs, which, you know, is, you know, I don't want to stereotype, but, you know, largely a bit of a Trump constituency. So, and certainly a lot of rural hospitals in Republican districts affected by that. What's the prospect for pushback just within the Republican Party?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And it's sort of hard to get at, because, you know, the Republican Party is now an authoritarian cult. And actually, the New York Times had an interesting report today about the confirmation of Pete Hegseth, which is the first one that sort of sailed through against the odds. And Tom Tillis, the Republican senator from North Carolina, indicated that he was leaning no on Hegseth's confirmation. And immediately the Trump White House swooped in and said, oh, yeah, you want a primary challenge next time out, pal? You better change your vote. And he did. So that's, you know, one reason that this is a constitutional crisis is, you know, to pan back a bit, the Constitution was designed so that each branch of government would jealously guard its independence, you know, and these powers of, you know, creating federal agencies and mandates and funding them all reside with Congress. So it is a first order failure, just institutionally and of constitutional governance, for the Republicans to just roll over this way. I would say I'm scandalized and appalled, but I've been awake for the past decades.
Well, and also, if they're ideologically sympathetic, anti-government, they're not standing up for the prerogatives of the congressional, the legislative branch of our government. But we're just almost out of time, Chris. So I just wanted to ask you one last question, which is, since it's Friday's media roundtable here on Your Call, what is the role of journalists and journalism today in covering up what's happening, this constitutional crisis, these illegal maneuvers, and the impacts that it's having for everyday people?
Well, sadly, you know, and The Nation and KALW are happy exceptions, but, you know, our major media institutions are owned by billionaires, including Elon Musk, who owns, you know, the most influential social media platform on the planet, probably. And we've seen already this long string now of capitulations to frivolous lawsuits that, you know, Trump files by habit. He loves this crap. So, he filed a defamation suit against ABC about an actually, you know, substantively accurate remark that George Stephanopoulos made about the E. Jean Carroll lawsuit. And ABC settled that, which sets a really bad precedent, especially for, you know, news organizations like ours that are not, you know, graced with deep pockets.
Well, it's such a great point about the media dynamics. And unfortunately, Chris, we're just about out of time, but there's so much more we can cover, and we'll have to have you back on as these events keep unfolding. But Chris Lehman, DC Bureau Chief for The Nation, contributing editor at The Baffler, and author most recently of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Thank you so much for joining us on Your Call.
Thank you, Ethan.
Listeners should know that Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. You can listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast on yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Marissa Orozco produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a wonderful Valentine's Day. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Call.